Well, the situation in Syria intensified this week with very much that sense that this was a story with a very, very dynamic edge. The suicide bomb attack, of course, 3 days ago, and rebel fighters seizing all four border crossings with Iraq and one into Turkey. And as I heard Martin Indyk, the Australian commentator, speak to Tony Jones on Thursday on Late Line, when you can't control your borders, when you are the regime, that is a major development in your state of health. Whether we're going to see the fall of that Assad regime anytime soon, or if at all, is still anyone's guess. But there are very serious implications for the surrounding region either way. And that's what we're going to try to focus on in this up until 8 o'clock. First, we'd like to talk about the significance of some of the elite Syrians who have defected in the past few weeks, particularly that of the Talas family, a very well-connected Sunni family into the Sunni merchant clan and long-standing colleagues of the al-Assad family. What does it mean to the regime that they are now leaving Bashar al-Assad in perhaps his greatest moment of need? Paul Salem is the director of the Carnegie Middle East Centre in Beirut in Lebanon, and I spoke to him later this week about what he considered these defections meant to the al-Assad regime.
Well, I think it's detrimental in two ways. One, as a symptom, that if members of the Talas family are beginning to defect, who are very close to the Assad family, it must mean that they are assessing the situation as rather hopeless. And if they are assessing it as hopeless, other members in the regime or close to the regime must be having the same assessment. Now, the second aspect of the importance of the defection, particularly that Manaf Talas, who is a young general who was close to Bashar and close to Bashar's brothers, he has defected, but he has remained completely quiet. It might indicate to me that he might be engaged in serious and quiet diplomacy or negotiations, possibly involving the Russians and other parties, because he and people like him could be necessary parts of a transition, something that might end up resembling Egypt or Yemen. We do need people from inside to coax the transition along if we're not to have a full-scale civil war which just ends in utter devastation.
I must say, one of the photos that I have of him, I think it was circulated by the Stratfor people, has a rather a cigar-smoking, dishevelled, a very good-looking man, I thought, Brigadier General. I noticed he was commanding the 105th Republican Guard Unit until February or March of this year when they struggled, quotes, to put down the rebellion in Homs. Can I assume this man has blood on his hands?
I think you can. He has been somewhat on the sidelines for a number of months. Of course, it's not always easy to tell who's in and who's out in an opaque system like the Syrian one. But he certainly was part of the regime, and he certainly was part of the crackdown in the early days, as were many in the leadership of the armed forces, the intelligence forces, the Ba'ath Party. But I do think, and it's the assessment of many people, that if there is to be a negotiated transition, which is sort of what was put on the table in Geneva, sort of what the Russians are trying to pull out of a hat, it will have to involve some people from the regime and some people from the opposition to have a transition that is political, that is negotiated, that doesn't lead to a complete collapse of state order and civil war. But yes, I would think that he probably has blood on his
hands. I mean, the reason I ask is that is there any risk of him being indicted for war crimes? Because obviously that Homs was a truly appalling situation.
Well, I mean, that's probably up to investigators and, you know, people who pour through detailed information. Myself, as an analyst, I don't have any privileged information to know what he did on what day and where. But that, of course, could be a problem in the future. And I'm sure there are many in the opposition who would not favor him as being part of a transition. But I'm just describing the general situation that some diplomats are trying to push forward, and many in Syria possibly would prefer a transition rather than a full-scale collapse of order, full-scale civil war, that might take many, many years to recover from.
Oh, I understand exactly what you mean. And just a little more about this family, the father of Manaf, Mustafa Tlas, is it correct, as has been reported, that he actually gave a deathbed pledge to Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, to protect the Assad family and the regime and to ensure that Bashar had the support of the old guard? I mean, in other words, they're just really, really on the inside.
Well, they are definitely really, really on the inside. Of course, you're talking about 12 years ago when Hafez al-Assad died, and certainly Mustafa Tlas and his son Manaf were key in managing and easing the transition of Bashar into the presidency. That is well known. You know, what he said to Hafez on his deathbed, I don't know. But the circumstances of 12 years ago are very, very different than the circumstances of today. Mustafa Tlas himself has been out of the country for some time, ostensibly for medical attention, but probably also distancing himself from what is going on.
Thank you very much indeed for your assessments. I appreciate them.
All right, all the best. Thank you.
Paul Salem, Director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Well, joining me now in the studio is Anthony Bubalo. Anthony's the director of the West Asia program at the Lowy Institute. And before joining the Institute, he served in Australian diplomatic missions in Saudi Arabia and Israel and was senior Middle East analyst with our Office of National Assessments. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Look, I noticed that the Australian today, in its world section, has Assad ready for, quotes, civilized departure. Then when I read the story, I wonder whether that's what the Russians are actually saying to Assad that he ought to be ready for. What's your judgment? Is there any real evidence of that?
I don't think so. I think we've heard this story before. I think you're right. The Russians certainly would like some kind of civilized departure, but I think it's far from clear that that's going to happen at this stage.
In fact, everybody we rang yesterday said something totally depressing. They said basically they will create havoc on the way out. It sort of almost sounded like, you know, the young men of Berlin being sent out and the old men of Berlin to defend Berlin against the incoming allies. Is that what it's going to be like?
Look, there's a very strong possibility it will be like that. Not just because the regime, you know, will create havoc on its way out, but it'll be a real struggle for power amongst an opposition that is very divided. For some of the minorities in Syria, it'll be a struggle for survival. So the likelihood that is that it will be very messy.
Let's just go through because it does your head in a little bit when you come from something small, little, nice, orderly country like Australia, trying to work out what's going to happen. Various people are suggesting that the real nation looking on with gross anxiety is Iraq. Is that your reading of it?
I think Iraq and Iran, because I think mainly Iran.
Iran more than Iraq.
Iran more than Iraq. Syria has been its most important national ally in the region since the 1980s. Mm. And if anything, in the last decade, its importance to Iran has increased. Syria is the main conduit through which Iran supports its most important kind of subnational ally in the region, Hezbollah in Lebanon. Mm. So Iran stands to lose a lot strategically if the regime changes in Syria. I think in Iraq they're concerned because Syria and Iraq have historically had lots of conflict in their relationships. And if a regime that is hostile to the one in Iraq emerges in Syria, as there has been in the past, then that causes them major security problems along that border.
I just heard the BBC correspondent this morning on news radio saying that it is acutely chilling for the Iraqis to look over at what is happening with the refugees streaming out, with jihadists streaming in, so you haven't even got your own people around you, with mayhem, with atrocities. You know, it just reminds them terribly of what happened in the insurgency and the hundreds of thousands who have probably died, and it's taking them years to recover, and they're only just, as it were, recovering. And so that it is a really terrible reminder for the Iraqis of what they've just emerged from, maybe, and what they could go back to.
Absolutely. And, you know, during the insurgency in Iraq, you did have these jihadist and insurgent groups that were based in Syria and coming across the border into
Run
Iraq.
Run by the Syrian internal police.
Well, some or hosted by the Syrians. Now you've got kind of the other situation where you've got Iraqi jihadists who were very much, you know, wiped out in the civil war in Iraq, being revived by this new opportunity in Syria and going back the other way.
Mm. It was also, reading the history, just thinking about chaos that might be coming, and I don't know whether you agree with the Stratfor analysis from the US, that there's nothing in chaos in Syria for anyone except maybe the al-Assads. I wonder if you think that's right or whether some people will be trying to foster chaos.
Look, the reason why this is so dangerous is that, say, unlike Libya, Syria is at the strategic heart of the Middle East. Many of the region's kind of conflicts and political divides run through Syria. So it's on the front line of the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's on the front line of the kind of the conflict between Iran and Sunni Arab states. You have major sectarian tensions, major ethnic tensions. That Syria has a significant Kurdish population. Mm. So it's not something, you know, chaos in Syria is not something people will be able to ignore and simply kind of allow to kind of happen. It could bring all sorts of consequences for Syria's neighbouring countries.
I read that Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, came to power in 1970 after 21 changes of government, mostly through coups, in Syria's first 24 years of independence. And he finally ended the chaos by being, as they wrote, the Leonid Brezhnev of the Arab world. So this is very, very sobering to remember, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Hafez al-Assad's great achievement was to be the first person that actually, first ruler of Syria that actually survived for a number of years. And that is the thing that doesn't give you a lot of confidence about what will happen in Syria next. You know, it has a long history, lots of divisions, sectarian, ethnic, political, and the fear is that these will come back again.
So it's a bit like Tito and Yugoslavia in its own
way. Well, yeah, in many ways, yeah.
So what about, just let's go through it bit by bit, where are the Turks in all of this?
The Turks are really interesting because up until the Arab uprisings, up until the Syrian uprising, the Turks were trying to foster better relations with Syria. And then as a result of the Arab uprising, that has turned around. The Turkish government has been very forceful in this, pushing the Assad regime to resign. They're very concerned about potential refugee flows into Turkey. They're concerned about the impact on the Kurdish issue. They've been hosting the Free Syrian Army, the main military opposition to the Syrian regime. So they are in it up to their chin.
Mm. What about the Saudis? Because it's believed that really a lot of this is because the Saudis, who we all read, you know, a year and a half ago, were worried about the Shiite Crescent. I remember thinking, oh, they'll do something about that in the future. Surely they're doing something about it now, and this is what we're watching?
Yeah, I mean, the Saudis, you know, even before the Arab uprising, the Saudis were trying to kind of wean Bashar al-Assad away from the Iranians. They saw him as central to rolling back the advances that Iran had made in the region over the last decade in particular. And I think with the Arab uprising, you know, they also saw this, and there was a sense of, even before the Arab uprising, of exasperation, of not being able to do that. And now with the Arab uprising, they see it as an opportunity for regime change in Syria and to change the kind of regional balance, to roll back some of Iran's advances. And so, you know, there are lots of stories about them putting money and arms into Syria and supporting the kind of different elements in the opposition.
But they're not interested in chaos, given the age of their rulers at the moment, are they?
They're not. But, you know, they see this as a major strategic opportunity. Remember that the Saudis read the Arab uprising in a couple of ways. One as, you know, a potential internal threat, but they also read it as a potential opportunity for their Iranian adversaries to kind of sow kind of chaos and discontent in the region, including potentially in Saudi Arabia, which has a significant Shiite population.
The Israelis, how will they be looking on at this?
Extremely nervously. I mean, it's not just Syria. they'll be looking at Egypt and even Jordan very nervously. The thing I think that worries the Israelis the most about Syria is that Syria has a very significant chemical weapons arsenal, and there's the potential if chaos ensues, if the regime's control breaks down, that some of those weapons will find their way into extremist hands or potentially even to Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Mm. In your view, is the best hope a deal between Ankara and Iran, backdoor deal, which allows some sort of transition to maybe that man like Manaf Talas, whom we were speaking about earlier, which the Americans won't openly like but will accept?
Look, I don't know. I think we're past deals now. I think we are heading, you know, if we're not in a civil war already, we are heading in that direction.
Really? You don't think there's any avoiding that?
No, I don't think, we've been through this now for months. People have been kind of talking and negotiating, almost as if nothing, almost completely disconnected with the reality on the ground in Syria. And it's the reality on the ground in Syria which will dictate what will happen now, not what happens in kind of capitals outside of Syria.
Oh, well, that was about the last thing I wanted to hear you say. Thank you very much indeed, Anthony Bublow. I appreciate it. I do hope that sort of knitted together and that little tapestry makes it easier to understand, because it is highly complex. Do leave a story comment on the Saturday Extra website. You can always tweet us as well, to me at Geraldine Doog, or ring the listener comment line 0283 5975.